Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
One more thing. Let me tell you about a new sponsor, Raygun. If you're wanting to detect and diagnose errors and crashes in your software, even find problems that you didn't know existed to improve your software, then Raygun might be perfect for you. You add a few lines of code to your application, and in minutes you'll get real-time error reports with all the information that you need to fix bugs fast. You can even hook it up to your team chat, bug tracking, development workflow tools. Raygun covers all major web and mobile programming languages, including .NET, the full Xamarin stack, JavaScript, and many more. Go check out Raygun today at raygun.io. I use this myself on my little startup, and I really, really recommend this product. It is a great, great product. Check it out, Raygun at raygun.io.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 471. In this episode, Scott talks with Dr. Danielle Smith about usability and the human factor.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I am talking with Dr. Danielle Smith from Sentier Strategic Resources. She has a PhD in psychology with a focus on human factors. You are a UX expert.
Yes, I am, Scott. Thank you.
I really appreciate talking to you. And I'm going to put in the show notes more information about Sentier and about the things that you've written up. But you've been exploring this space for a great deal of time, trying to make the experience better for the user, right? You work for the user. You're like,
yes.
Tron.
Yeah, I do. The thing about UX is that it's such a broad field that I feel like I always have to have this disclaimer, is that I really focus on the psychology of things. So I do a lot of research. I do a little bit of design, but nothing I've ever designed has just gone out into the public. There's other parts of UX that make things more polished and more attractive.
Right. There's a difference between someone that is, dragging the button and saying the bevel should be like this and the color theme, yes, should be like that. But you're saying that what you focus on is this user experience is quantifiably more effective than user experience B?
Yes, most of the time. Mm-hmm. The thing about it is, it's a little bit of art, a little bit of science, and sometimes we can quantify it and sometimes we can't, but we use the idea of this is the way that humans operate. So like you said, I have a degree in psychology. So mm-hmm. Humans think this way. They perceive things this way. So we use that to say that in times that we can't quantify things, to say that this one is likely to be better. So
how often in computer interactions and UX interactions does culture matter? Like, does a Canadian interact with a website different than a Mexican or a European?
Not very often. Surprisingly enough, like, a lot of times we go into things thinking that culture matters a lot, but it's hard to predict, honestly. Mm-hmm. So we end up testing things anyway, or releasing them out into the wild and monitoring them to see if culture matters. But a lot of times it doesn't. And then when it does matter, it matters in weird ways.
What's a weird way that culture would matter?
My favorite example is trying to deliver a survey. Like, you try to... you design your survey instrument, you test it, you make sure all the words are right, you translate it into, let's say, Chinese, and then launch it. And you're like, oh, everybody in China is really happy about this product, so much more than everybody in the United States. Mm-hmm. When really it's just people use scales differently. Culture dictates the way people use scales. And
interesting. I can imagine Americans being like, one, that sucks. But the Chinese might be like, I really don't want to hurt those people's feelings. So I will say seven.
Exactly. My favorite thing to do is to test things in Germany because you kind of get the no.
In my mind, I was like, nein! So that's good, right? No, that is not good. We suck in Germany. Okay. Yeah. So if culture doesn't matter, now that was geographic culture, but what about like, you know, products for salespeople and business people versus for non-technical parent? You know, that psychology is significant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Very much so. So that's actually one of the fields that I specialize in, is sort of decision making under uncertainty. And when people are less technically savvy, they make more guesses, even though they may not know they're making guesses. So you want to have really strong, clear affordances. So like clear direction as to what they should do versus mm-hmm. lots of options. But when you're designing for a business setting where people have certain expectations about tasks that they want to be able to do, you try to design more flexibility. But still, people are people. You give them too many options, they'll make guesses. And so you have to balance that very carefully.
That phrase, I really like that, decision-making under uncertainty. I feel like I come into a situation with my non-technical parents where they're like, you know, I did something to the computer. Like they reflexively feel that they, you know, whatever went wrong with that survey or that website or this check deposit was my fault.
Yes. And I, as a usability, as a person who does a lot of usability testing, I find myself reassuring people. Don't worry. It's not your fault. It's the computer's fault. But people do. They internalize it. They want, believe it or not, most people want the thing that they bought to work. And so they tend to get mad at themselves because they don't want to think they are wrong and think expecting this thing to work.
Yeah. I had a lot of really uncomfortable conversations about Windows 8. And the issue was, is it not usable or is it unfamiliar? Because fast forward 2 years from now, you know, 2 years into the present right now, most people that I talk to that have used Windows 8 for years are quite comfortable with it. So then it was the fact that it was unfamiliar that made us assume it was unintuitive. And that got me to thinking, like, is the only reason that the start menu makes sense is because it's been around for 25 years?
Yeah, that's the hard thing. Like every time that a new paradigm comes up, you have to think about it that way. Like, is it really something about the interface that makes it not fit for human consumption? Or is it just the newness of it? So once I did a lot of work with keyboards. So mm-hmm. whenever you change a keyboard, especially with a business setting with touch typists, people are angry. Like keycap height, how wide they are, like, no matter how much analysis we do to show that it results in less stress or it's more, you don't have any more or less errors using the new keyboard, people are angry. So you kind of have to wait and see if they adapt to the new idea.
I think that users get deeply attached to their computers. You know, like when you move someone's cheese, they will freak out because this is where they live.
Right. And they don't really care about you. They don't care about your computer. They live here. They are just trying to live. And if some new design comes along that is ultimately better for one reason or another, if the user doesn't perceive that right away, they have no motivation.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that on iPads and in the world of tablets, people now, as we're several years into that world, are convinced that tablets are completely intuitive. But it seems to me that we spend a lot of time with applications that would dim out the entire screen and have a shadow hand saying, touch there. Like if tablets were that intuitive, I don't think that every iPad app wouldn't have a first run experience. It was like, touch here. Like, oh, okay, I'll touch there.
Exactly. Like I had that experience. Like I gave my grandmother a tablet a couple of months ago and I tried to get her to call me on Skype and I was like, just press the camera icon. And she's like, what camera icon? There is no camera icon. Oh, you mean this rectangle with a triangle next to it? Oh, okay. It's like, oh, right.
Yeah. Even now today, like Android phones, I still haven't figured out what the three icons at the bottom are. Like one of them's kind of shaped like a Monopoly house. So I think it means home, but the other ones I have no. And the hamburger, what is the hamburger? You know what I'm talking about? The three lines. Do. Like, that's now become a thing.
I know. And no matter how many studies that wonderful UX people do and publish that say that performance is so much better if you have the word that says menu versus a hamburger, we're continuing to push that. And it remains to be seen if like, in 5 years, my grandma will be like, oh, yeah, I just hit the hamburger and it works.
I don't think grandma knows it's called a hamburger. And no. One of my most popular blog posts is the one that an entire generation of people are pushing on the save icon without even having ever seen a floppy disk.
Oh, yeah.
It's iconic. So you say that studies have come out that say that the hamburger does not perform as well as a simple button marked menu. Then where is the disconnect between you, who have the knowledge and the data and the scholarly research to prove that this is a bad idea, and as you mentioned earlier, kind of downstream, some designer overrode you and said, no, no, hamburgers are prettier.
Well, kind of the same reason that Blu-ray exists. You know, there is a larger business vision that human factors people and UX people do have to fit into. Mm-hmm. And if, as an industry, like, oh, hamburgers are prettier, but they also save us space and they when you go responsive, it works a lot better, then we do make some trade-offs. And as long as people don't fail, you know, can't complete the main task of, you know, checking out or saving their document or whatever it is, then we will go ahead and make other allowances.
I think one of the other challenges about UX is that once you've poisoned the user by teaching them that those three lines are the menu, well, then now they're poisoned and they're no longer a fresh person that you can introduce this concept to. Now, I can't get any valid data out of this person. They know that already.
Yeah. The hard thing is that it's hard to know when they know. So just because someone's used something, they may not even remember that that's the way it happened. Because like I said, they don't really care about your thing. They care about the thing they're trying to do. So you'll see a lot of research where you'll have someone do a task. So I'll have someone go check out with their phone at a coffee shop and with some new app that I've downloaded to their device. And at the end of the session or at the end of the task, they will tell me, so how did that go? And they will describe something completely different than what happened because they don't really care. They just wanted the coffee that I was giving them for free for using the app. So I will observe and watch the way they handle things and note what needs to change. But when we have them recall, they don't necessarily remember the experience.
That is interesting. So that's why you record these things from multiple angles and in the screen and all that information.
Right.
I think that also once people have done something a few times, there's a kinesthetic aspect of things where the physicality of it, like I don't even know how to make a new mail in Gmail anymore. I just go Alt Tab and then C and then start typing, you know, like I don't even see the compose button anymore.
Yes.
Like I get tunnel vision.
Exactly. Like the classic example of that is that do you know how to drive? Like, can you describe the small micro movements you make when you drive?
Oh, wow. Okay. And I bet that if you ask someone to give you a recipe, they would miss a step, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they would miss a step. They would not think about, you know, how they let their foot off the gas or how they move their hands when they turn the wheel. They wouldn't necessarily remember all of that.
That's interesting. You know, I just realized as I'm running through the steps in my head, I didn't even think about you have to push the brake before you turn the car on.
Yes.
I actually had to drive to pick up a friend. I had to drive like 2 miles. They called me. The car won't start. This is a person who'd been driving for 20 years. For whatever reason, on that random Tuesday morning, they forgot that they had to push the brake to start the car.
Yeah.
So they were sitting there with 2 feet on the ground trying to start this car, and they couldn't figure it out. And I said, well, here, put your foot here. Oh, like you've been driving for 20 years. What is wrong with you?
Or like people that never filled up their gas tank. It's amazing to watch them at gas stations.
Hey now, I live in Oregon and it is illegal to pump your own gas here.
Really?
You didn't know this?
No, I did not.
Oregon has no sales tax and it has where you're physically not allowed, it is illegal to fill your tank. So when I my first drive up to Washington, I just sat there for like 20 minutes. Is anybody going to come and help me out? And even now, true story, I am still not 100% sure if I'm doing it right.
Yeah. It's amazing the things that you kind of take for granted. And that's one of the reasons why kind of my profession exists, right? Mm-hmm. Because developers, designers, hardware manufacturers, they do their thing really well, right? You are responsible to make sure that my computer does not blow up and it works. Mm-hmm. But you sort of take it, you forget about the bits of the experience that you you take for granted.
Well, I think that also people think that UX is at the beginning of a very long waterfall. Mm-hmm. When I think it's more of a cycle, and I think that we as software developers, I know it myself, rarely at the end of the waterfall when the product has shipped, feed that data back to you.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you need. There's a cycle of improvement here. And for so many large systems, there's massive amounts of data that are simply not being collected that you probably could be using to make the experience better.
Oh, definitely. That's so one of the things about human factors, and as opposed to some other sort of more targeted experience or fields, is that we tend to look at the broader system. And at different places I work, they really do look at me like, oh, okay, you're there for the beginning. You know, when it's on paper or when it's just the UI and it's not hooked up to the back. But you get the most amount, or you get a lot of information at that point, but you get a lot of good information when it's out in the field. So like, how do things fail? Where does the funnel kind of break down? And then what sort of calls are you getting? Like, customer service is sort of the richest untapped bit of UX refinement potential that's out there.
Mm.
Because that's when you find out, you know, what kinds of people have problems, because maybe we didn't think that they were part of our target audience. So we didn't even test with them in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You find out what they're trying to do. Because again, we start off with sort of a core set of assumed tasks. And folks may be trying to do something completely different or in an environment that we didn't think about. And so we have this opportunity to actually grow, to grow the experience as well as refine it, if that makes sense.
And do you think that large companies are dropping the ball, that they are missing this opportunity to grow the experience?
Yeah, I do. I feel like there's a lot of good initiatives out there that are trying to close this loop. There's lots of companies that have like customer experience programs, but they don't necessarily talk to the UX team. That is a different organization. It's run sometimes out of quality, sometimes out of customer service, but that loop back is something that's missing. So like when you deal with a large corporation, you're most of the time painfully aware of that. You'll buy some new product, have a problem, call in, and they know nothing about you, even though like some of these companies should know a lot about you. So your cable provider, for example, you're having a problem, you call in and they have to ask you what's the name on the front of your cable box? It's like, wait a minute, didn't you ship this to me? Why do you not know what this is? So I feel like large companies have a lot of resources and a lot of data that they can be using to kind of close that loop and make things continuously better.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, SyncFusion. SyncFusion's mobile, web, and desktop controls are trusted worldwide, but did you know that they also provide educational resources? The Succinctly series of free ebooks has great content on popular technologies in 100 completely ad-free pages. These books are written by industry experts, and topics range from Cassandra to Node.js to Windows 8.1. They are available for Kindle apps and in PDF format, and new ebooks are released each month, so browse their library at syncfusion.com to download your free ebook today. It seems like, is the problem organizational willpower? I mean, you just described something simple. Like, I know that it's always a joy when I call customer support and they say, hello, Scott, because they saw the caller ID and their you know, CRM system loaded my name up. And they're like, oh, are you calling about this? The issue I called about 3 hours ago.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, you actually care about me. But customers were like, the first 5 minutes of the call is just figuring out who the heck I am. It's like, you all don't care. Yeah. That must mean your CEO and leadership don't care about me.
Right. And that's the way you feel. And that's the way I feel when I call.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like a lot of it is sometimes it's organizational will. Yes. It may be some older company with an older mantra of this is the way things go. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the times it's just large companies are like working in a city. Like, you don't know what you don't know. You know, you work in this department and these are your responsibilities. You don't know that you need to take the initiative personally to go out and meet the heads of all these other departments and see how what they do affects your work. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you're not necessarily rewarded for that because you have your own goals. Your manager has their own goals and processes are put in place to sort of stifle that.
Exactly. I've always said that if it's not your job, then it's not your job.
It's not your job.
So if it's not anybody's job, then it doesn't get done. So then that means that a large company like, you know, an AT&T or Progressive Insurance or someone big like that, they should have a for lack of a better word, a UX czar who is looking at that 50,000 foot view and trying to fix the problems. Like they should practice calling in as a customer and see what that experience is, make sure everyone reminds themselves what that experience is like.
Yeah, ideally that they would have that because seeing what that experience is like and then trying to solve that problem internally, like the UX czar both has to look outside as what the customer is like, what customer experience is like, as well as inside to see what it's like for a designer to try to fix that problem. Like trying to find that data that you need to see like who's calling a customer service, like what's the problem? What's the drop-off rate or anything like that? It's really hard to do from inside of a company, which is not necessarily intuitive.
Mm-hmm. There's this equation to tell how many habitable planets there are. Have you ever heard about this equation? It is called the, what is the name of this? I'll have to look this up. But basically, it's one of these equations where they say, we're going to estimate how many, you know, aliens there are in the world. And they go and they'll say, all right, we'll start with the average number of stars and the average, and it's a sales pipeline.
Yeah.
But the thing that's so interesting about it is that if you change even one variable, like the fraction of life supporting planets, the number can be, yeah, there's one planet or yeah, there's a billion planets. And the same thing happens with regard to UX in a sales pipeline. Like one confusing form on how to put your credit card in and you could have 50% drop off and people just like give up.
Right. It is crazy. But yeah, I need that formula. I need to start using that.
Yeah, I feel like but the data. Do I have data about abandoned shopping carts?
Yes.
That's probably not even collected.
And not in every case. Like that's something I learned by working at different companies is that the data's not even there all the time. Like you have to make the conscious effort as the product manager, as the developer, to instrument this page, this feature, mm-hmm. or whatever. And yeah.
So that's called the Drake equation, it turns out. It's the way to estimate the number of active extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. And that is a sales pipeline, you know, isn't it? And it can change drastically with just a little bit of drop off. If somebody fails to put in their credit card, then, you know, your sales go down by 10, 20, you know, some measurable significant percentage.
Yeah. I think I need to start using that equation too.
Yeah, I think you should develop your own. We'll have the Smith equation and it will be an explanation of, you know, UX errors and issues and all those little tiny, it's like death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, over time. That's mm-hmm. the problem.
Now you had an experience, we were talking earlier before the show about something you had trouble with AT&T, you know, an example of a really large company.
Yeah, actually, I have AT&T UVerse internet and cable. Mm-hmm. About a year into this journey with AT&T, I started to have a beeping noise in my garage. So I called them and say, hey, there's something with your name on it that's beeping in my garage.
That's a reasonable question.
Right. I mean, you know me. You installed all this stuff. So their response is, oh, well, it's your battery that powers your voice over IP system. We only supply the first battery. You have to buy the second one. Would you like us to ship you one and charge you for it? And I was like, and my response was, no, I do not have voice over IP with you. And, you know, 20 minutes worth of getting transferred, they come back. I was like, oh no, you do not have voice over IP. However, you must have had voice over IP last year when we installed this system. It's like, no, I have never had voice over IP through AT&T. So 20 more minutes worth of transferring. And, you know, my husband's getting frustrated. It's Saturday. I was like, I don't know what's going on. And finally, it was, oh, no, sorry. You have voice over IP. I don't know how we don't know that you have voice over IP, but the only way we can make the beeping stop in your garage is for you to pay for a technician to come out and take the beep.
So you never paid for a voice over IP. Do you know who put that box in there?
Yeah, it was AT&T.
But like, did they tell you, like, oh, by the way, we're throwing a voice over IP box in your garage?
No, they were like, oh, this is part of what UVerse is for your neighborhood. This is all the things we have to do. The guy had been in my house for like 8 hours. I'm sure he just wanted to put everything as possible in my house.
Wow. So you had basically a bunch of unwanted, unused equipment in anticipation, perhaps, of someday that you would, you know, maybe use voice over IP.
Maybe. But luckily, I'm married to an electrician who was able to make the beeping stop, and we still have internet.
Yeah, I had a similar issue with Fios where it was one of those situations where they're telling me that something is so, right? This is an example where they're in a CRM system and they said, no, but Dr. Smith, this is so. It says right here in the CRM, like, no, you don't understand. I'm in the garage, right?
Yes.
Like you don't get to argue with me. I don't care what your CRM says. That cable that you're asking me to pull or that object that you say is not beeping is sitting right here. Let me hold the phone up to it.
Yes.
It's always some failure for some piece of data that has gone through that process. And it seems to me like this should have been solved with data. Something was disconnected between the time the person installed it and then when they put it in their system for, you know, and made it data.
Yeah. And it happens all the time, right? And it makes you feel like there needs to be some sort of, well, it makes me feel like there needs to be some sort of system integration test, right? Where the human is part of the system. There's different levels of involvement, and you just see how it goes. And then when things break down, you identify that to be fixed and actually fix it. That's the problem with like all of these sort of failures that I think of, is that I don't feel like they're getting fixed. Like me hanging up on AT&T after an hour, I don't think that now they know I don't have voice over IP and they need to come and do something.
I had another funny UX kind of situation. I had Fios, right? It was Verizon Fios, mm-hmm. and then it became Frontier Fios, similar to UVerse, a package deal. And I got rid of the DVR, right? The TV recorder. So I took it to the local Fios company. I said, here's my DVR. And then I realized that I had actually had two. I had one in a spare bedroom. So the next day or the next week, I got the second one and I went to the office and it was gone. It was empty. It was just an empty, the entire office had disappeared. It was almost like one of those movies where the NSA had taken them all away. So I called them and told them that what had happened and they didn't believe me. They it was a disconnect again. And then I said, well, you send me a box and then I will send you back this DVR. Mm-hmm. So they sent me a box and I sent them back the DVR. Every month for the next 2 years, I got an empty box to send back the DVR because they never got it. Right? So God knows where the DVR is. So after 2 years of this and literally a collection of cardboard, I called them and said, I don't have the DVR. And they said, okay, that'll be $300.
Oh my goodness.
Isn't it in UX? It seems like the human gets blamed for the problem when the system is so much larger than the human. It's so much more likely that it's not my fault.
Right. It is so much. And how much money did they waste on you? I mean, seriously, shipping
more than
those
$200.
Boxes. Yes. and that's sort of the thing. Like, I feel like web experiences, app experiences, even enterprise application experiences, the mantra of UX has been very successful. So you see a lot more slicker interactions inside of applications, sort of contained experiences. But as an industry, we need to work towards getting that, raising that up, you know, making it broader into the entire experience. Because things are only getting more complex. You're getting more devices that are awesome on their own. But as they fit into your larger, your life, how do they work together? What is that experience like?
Exactly. I think that things are slicker and prettier than ever before. And we love to call that UX.
Yes.
But I still had to set up my non-technical spouse's iPhone, which is supposed to be the simplest device on the planet, right? But it involved me logging into iCloud like 16 times.
Oh, don't get me started. yeah.
So what do we tell our listeners then who are maybe going to their big company job right now? Do they maybe they don't even know if they have a UX person, or maybe they need to bring a consultant in.
Well, you can always reach out to me and I will help you any way I can. But the other thing is just to ask around. Ask if there's some companies have UX people. They call themselves UX professionals. Some companies have human factors engineers or industrial engineers. And while their responsibilities may be slightly different, they can at least point you in the right direction.
Very cool. I'm going to put in the show notes the links to Centaur Strategic Resources, which is the UX and human factors company that you work at with a number of other partners. And then also some of your Google Scholar pages and your Twitter as well, if you don't mind.
Oh, I don't mind.
Thank you very much, Dr. Danielle Smith. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.